addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available from iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
President Biden said he would not pardon his son, Hunter, but he did. Criticism and praise for his decision. White women's unwavering allegiance to Donald Trump and the Republican Party. And scholars thought white women were passive enslavers of African people. They were wrong. Professor Rachel Swarms, the author of New York Times article, joins us. And good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, first, these stories topping the news. President Biden has reversed his vow not to pardon his son, Hunter, and has pardoned his son, Hunter, on federal firearm charges and tax evasion. In issuing a 10-year pardon that covers all crimes, whether charged or uncharged, Biden asserted that his son was, quote, selectively and unfairly prosecuted and treated differently, end quote. It has, not surprisingly, unleashed an avalanche of criticisms of Biden that he lied repeatedly to the American people throughout the campaign, and that essentially he gave Hunter a get-out-of-jail-free card for the next 10 years. President-elect Donald Trump's lawyers argued in court Monday, citing the Hunter pardon, that Trump should have the criminal hush money case in New York immediately dismissed. His lawyers also invoked special counsel Jack Smith's motion to throw out both of the federal cases against Trump based on a Justice Department policy prohibiting the prosecution of a sitting president. Trump was convicted of falsifying records to cover up paying porn star Stormy Daniels to stay quiet before the 2016 election about an alleged sexual encounter between the two of them. He was initially scheduled to be sentenced in July, but he has now gotten several sentencing dates wiped from the calendar as he tries to get his felony convictions tossed out. Prosecutors must file their response to Trump's request by December 9th. That's next Monday. They have already said they will oppose the motion, although they have also acknowledged the, quote, demands and obligations of the presidency, end quote. Keith Boykin is an American TV and film producer, a national political commentator, a social media influencer, an author, and former White House aide to President Bill Clinton. He offers his commentary on the Biden pardon.
President Biden has pardoned his son, Hunter Biden, and you know what? I would have done the same thing. If Donald Trump could be elected president as a convicted felon, I'd be damned if I let my own son go to prison for the sake of a principle that only one side believes in. When I went to law school, they used to say that no one is above the law. Clearly, that's a damn lie with white privilege in America. White privilege is Donald Trump having 34 felony convictions and still winning the majority of the white vote for president. White privilege is Matt Gaetz being nominated for attorney general while facing child sex trafficking allegations. White privilege is unqualified Fox News host Pete Hegseth being nominated as defense secretary while facing sexual assault allegations. White privilege is slumlord Charles Kushner committing a federal crime, watching his son get a White House job with no security clearance, watching him leave the White House with $2 billion from the Saudis, being pardoned by your son's father-in-law, and then this week being nominated to serve as U.S. ambassador to France. White privilege is storming the U.S. Capitol in a deadly insurrection and being called a hero and a hostage by the incoming president of the United States. The Republican Party spent the past 50 years building a brand as the Law and Order Party and threw it all away when it nominated and elected a twice-impeached convicted felon as president. Any MAGA cult member who defends the Trump crime family and their associates has no credibility to complain about Hunter Biden now or forever.
Commentator attorney Keith Boykin. Well, for weeks, President Biden has faced calls to use his clemency powers to save the lives of federal inmates on death row ahead of the transfer of power to President Trump, President-elect Donald Trump, who has said he will expand the use of the death penalty. Biden recently pardoned two Thanksgiving turkeys as part of an annual tradition to highlight these presidential constitutional powers, but he has not issued commutations for the 40 incarcerated men on federal death row. Quote, if Biden does not act, there is little doubt that Trump will aggressively schedule executions in his next term. Their blood will primarily be on Trump's hands, but if Biden does not act to prevent it, his hands will be bloody too. That's according to Matt Brunig, president of the People's Policy Project think tank, reacting to the news of the Hunter Biden pardon. The pardoning of Hunter Biden, who was awaiting sentencing on two federal cases, also prompted scrutiny around pardon actions Biden could take that are not just focused on death row. Quote, this, wrote Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, in response to a post on the X that contrasted the Hunter Biden pardon with the fact that tens of thousands of people are in federal custody for drug offenses. On November 20th, over 60 members of Congress sent a letter to Biden encouraging him to use his clemency powers to help broad classes of people and cases, including the elderly and chronically ill, those on death row, people with unjustified sentencing disparities, and women who were punished for defending themselves against their abusers, end quote. During a press conference in November that featured House Democrats and anti-death penalty advocates, Representative Ayanna Pressley, a Democrat from Massachusetts, said that, quote, those on death row who are now at risk of barbaric and inhumane murder at the hands of the Trump administration can have their death sentence commuted and be resentenced to a prison term. That's according to the Oklahoma Voice. We're here today to ask him to take another step, she said, in that direction, and to demonstrate once again a very positive consequence of his having been elected our 46th president and to carry out his clemency powers in a very positive way. That is a quote from Representative James Clyburn, a Democrat from South Carolina. Meanwhile, the ACLU has also urged Biden to use the lame duck session to commute federal death sentences, pointing out that Trump has vowed to expand the death penalty, including to non-homicide crimes, such as drug-related offenses. Quote, the death penalty is a morally bankrupt and inescapably racist institution. President Biden came into office committing to abolish the federal death penalty because of its fundamental flaws. Commuting the federal row is the way he can honor that commitment and prevent irreversible miscarriages of justice, said Yasmin Cater, ACLU Deputy Legal Director, and the director of the Trone Center for Justice and Equality. A California lawmaker will introduce a bill that would give descendants of slaves priority for admission to the two largest public university systems in the state of California. Assemblymember Isaac Bryan, a Democrat, told the Associated Press, universities have given admission priority to certain applicants for decades, which benefited mostly donors and their families. Quote, for decades, universities gave preferential admission treatment to donors and their family members while others tied to legacies of harm were ignored and at times outright excluded, end quote. We have a moral responsibility to do all we can to right those wrongs. The U.S. Supreme Court outlawed affirmative action last year in college admissions, and by banning affirmative action but allowing legacy preferences, which favor the children of alumni and donors, critics say the court left admissions even more lopsided against students of color. There is a growing understanding of California's role in perpetrating the inequalities that arose from slavery, and there's a willingness to try to rectify that harm, to heal that harm, said Bryan. Under the bill, the descendants of slaves would be given admission priority to the University of California and California State University systems. In 2023, Black students made up about 4% of the California State University student population and about 4.7% at the University of California. That's according to the university's system's latest reports. The move comes as the incoming Trump administration is expected to limit diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, or DEI programs, as it's called. In a little attended session in the House chambers on Capitol Hill, U.S. Representative Jasmine Crockett, a Democrat from Texas, sought to school her colleagues across the aisle of the historic Foundation for DEI, or Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Representative Jasmine Crockett.
The person that she is, she showed us just really she is not the brightest bulb in the dark room. Play.
Would you say that this is an abuse of that separation of power? Because that rule is not something that Congress has delegated, but the ATF has taken it upon itself to regulate this rule that they created to make millions of Americans felons.
With respect, I was trying to answer your question before you interrupted me to say that the ATF had, in each of these instances, sufficient statutory authority from Congress, and that any challenges to that.
Ms. Katzen, it is my time. So Congress never authorized the ATF to ban pistol braces. Congress never authorized the ATF to do that, to make millions of Americans felons overnight. And so I would go back to your statement that you said in your testimony these agencies are not free agencies, and they can only do what Congress has delegated to them to do.
Congress is not specific.
It's my time. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you are not interested in my views.
It is my time. Thank you.
In your testimony,
you stated Congress delegates, but then some officials are quick to condemn the agencies for.
Well, that was rude. That didn't sit too well with Jasmine Crockett. Here's a Texas congresswoman.
This committee runs my pressure up. And I do come prepared to committee, and then there's always somebody from this side that does something ridiculous that throws me all the way off. So, Jesus. Okay, so this is where we're going to start, Ms. Kaskin. First of all, let me apologize because that was uncalled for. So let me do what she would never do, which is to be an adult in this room or in this chamber. So let me start there. I'm also going to start with some nonsense that she was trying to spew. And unlike Ms. Boebert, I am legally trained and I've passed a few bar exams. And I also legislated before I got here. So I do want to start with correcting the record a little bit. And if you want to add to that, please do. There was conversation about ATF because my colleagues love to talk about their guns, baby. And I'm from Texas. So let me be clear. I also own firearms. Democrats own guns too. Let me make it clear. I own guns and I'm licensed to carry. That is a regulation. Regulations aren't necessarily bad. It didn't stop me from being able to get a gun. So we were talking about, or y'all were talking about the ATF, which I wasn't going there. I didn't plan to go there. But you know what? I honestly wish the ATF would run amok because we know that seemingly the people that run this chamber don't have the courage to come up with one of the things we've heard is common sense regulations when it comes to guns. And to be clear, our Constitution, the Second Amendment, anticipates people having common sense. Unfortunately, we have not done that. And unfortunately, it has cost us lives. So when you were testifying a little bit earlier, you talked about unintended consequences and the fact that we are supposed to be able to anticipate that as lawmakers when we are writing laws. Unfortunately, not only have we ignored the unintended consequences, but we've got foreseeable consequences that are continually ignored. And that is why we are talking about regulation, at least on this side of the aisle. And our definition of common sense is one that doesn't keep us in the pockets of corporations, but keeps us in the pockets of the people. Because what I'm trying to do is save lives. My job isn't here to make sure that I'm pushing the bottom line for some corporation, but it's to make sure that the people that put me into this seat, which were actual people, individuals, to make sure that I can save lives. So let's talk about my state, because we always got good stuff coming out of Texas. Unfortunately, my state decided that it didn't want to be a part of the overall national grid because my state did not want to deal with all of the quote-unquote red tape. The cost of that was lives. So we had this winter storm, and here it was, I was freshly being sworn into the Texas House, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do because I started getting calls because there is this thing called climate change. Hello, nobody's in the chamber on the other side. But climate change is this real thing. And so in Texas, we had this terrible storm that took place. And even though we are an energy capital.
And that is, or was, U.S. Representative Jasmine Crockett of Texas, an excerpt from a Roland Martin program. She was actually speaking in Congress eloquently, not about the issue we thought, on diversity, equity, and inclusion, but she was her usual eloquent, intelligent self. So we'll be back in 60 seconds, and joining us live, New York University Professor Rachel Swarms to discuss her article, Scholars Thought White Women Were Passive Enslavers of African People. They were wrong. Stay with us.
WPFW Local Station Board presents their final Town Hall meeting of 2024 on Saturday, December 7th at New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., from noon until 2:30 p.m. The Town Hall will also be on Zoom, and the link can be found at WPFWFM.org. As this will be our last Town Hall at our present location, 1990 K Street, Northwest, we hope that you will attend this important meeting to discuss WPFW's relocation plans, as well as other issues facing the station. If attending in person, healthy refreshments will be served, and plenty of street parking is available. We hope to see you there, noon, December 7th, at New Bethany Baptist Church.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, joining me in the Zoom studio is Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University, Rachel Swarms. She writes about race and history for the New York Times. Her articles about Georgetown University's roots in slavery touched off a national conversation about American universities and their ties to this painful period in history. Her work has been recognized by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Ford Foundation, the McDowell Artist Residency Program, and others. Last year, she was elected to the Society of American Historians, and the list of accomplishments and acknowledgments of Professor Swarm goes on and on and on. But since we want to get to the issue this morning, I'm going to stop there. Good morning, Professor Swarms, and how are you this morning? You have to unmute yourself. And she has also written an article in the New York Times titled Scholars Thought White Women Were Passive Enslavers of African People, but they were wrong. Good morning, Professor Swarms.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, indeed. So how would you describe the image that scholars have portrayed of white women and their role in slavery? And explain what you mean by passive. Because I'm a little confused about how anybody could be passive about an institution as horrific as slavery. The mere knowledge that has taken place or existed on your plantation means you gave at least tacit endorsement.
You know, you're absolutely right there. So, you know, a lot of my work focuses on slavery and its legacy. So I wrote a book about Michelle Obama's ancestors, American Tapestry, and my most recent book was about how slavery fueled the growth of Georgetown University and the American Catholic Church. So when I stumbled across this study, this working paper that came out earlier this year from the National Bureau of Economic Research, I was super intrigued. And what the scholarship had been was there were assumptions, some of them kind of sexist assumptions, some of them because of how the law was framed. There were these assumptions that white women were not kept their hands clean, as it were, in the dirty business of buying and selling people. So the passive in the headline of the story that I wrote dealt with that, like they weren't in the market, they weren't looking at prices, they were, you know, at home, yes, you know, supervising and often maltreating folks, but that they weren't involved in the buying and selling, the active buying and selling, the active destruction of families, right? There was a thought that white women just wouldn't be involved in that kind of thing. There were also laws that prevented married white women, you know, paternalistic system that prevented women from owning property and acquiring wealth. You know, it was the husbands who controlled that. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, that was the understanding. And a Black professor at California Berkeley, Stephanie Jones Rogers, just a few years ago, published a book challenging that notion. And this recent working paper that I wrote about actually put some numbers to that.
Mm-hmm. So what evidence challenges this perspective, and how active were white women in actually sustaining and resisting the institution of slavery?
So the numbers are pretty striking. So this study done that came out this year by Trayvon Logan at Ohio State University found that between 1856 and 1861, a third of the transactions, the buying and selling of Black people in New Orleans, the largest slave market in the United States, were conducted by women, nearly a third. And he has other numbers too.
So they were buying slaves.
They were buying and selling. They were in the market. They were you know, following fluctuations of prices. Dr. Jones Rogers, in her book, realized the reason why she got interested in this was she knew this scholarship, right, that said, you know, no, white women weren't active. But she was reading the narratives written by formerly enslaved people, by Black people. And they talked about white women in a very different way. They talked about their active participation at auctions. And she said to herself, what is this kind of, there's a disconnect here. Mm-hmm. How does that happen? And guided by, you know, the words of the people who experienced the enslavement themselves, she dug into this and discovered that traditional idea wasn't true.
So in addition to them being active participants at the marketplace in the buying and selling of human beings, they had a role that they played on the actual plantation of the slaves. I remember when I went to the African American Museum and sitting there on the woman's, you know, those little, on her vanity. And I said, a pearl handled whip? And this was so that Miss Anne could whip the slaves. So that kind of alerted me that her role was not as passive as we have been thought to believe. What did you find? In what ways did white women exercise power and control over the enslaved people? And how is this power justified or rationalized in the context of societal norms?
So, you know, what Dr. Jones Rogers found was that actually not only did white women, you know, buy and sell people in the market, but that the enslavement of people actually gave them more economic freedom, because I mentioned that the laws traditionally prevented women from acquiring property, but there were specific carve-outs that allowed white women to acquire enslaved people. It was the one avenue that women could use to acquire wealth on their own. So you have this crazy thing where the enslavement of people, Black people, contributed to the economic freedom of some white women. And there are reports, as you talk about, in the households of violence, not just inflicted by white men, but when you talk about that whip that you saw by white women as well. I think it's important to note, too, obviously, that there were white women who were abolitionists, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we know about the Grimkes and Harriet Beecher Stowe and Lucretia Mott, often tinged with racism and paternalism, even in the mix, complicated sometimes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But there were those women. But I think it's really important to understand that this institution of slavery was, you know, this the benefits were crossing gender lines.
Now, these women that were able to buy and sell human beings, African people, in the marketplace, were they single women? Why were they allowed to do? They were single women, and you know, I've often. Oh, go ahead.
No, yeah, and so that was one of the. So one of the thoughts was exactly that they must have been single women, but this quantitative research that came out this year showed that married there was not huge distinctions between single and married women in terms of being engaged, actively engaged in this. And in part, that had to do with these laws that carved out, that gave women the ability to acquire property in, you know, human mm-hmm. property.
And, you know, I think I remember seeing reports where sometimes slaves were, what women inherited slaves from,
absolutely,
you know.
Absolutely right. And people thought of that as a passive, when the passive thing was kind of like, oh, they inherited, it was not, you know, it was a passive thing. It wasn't, you know, like going out and buying people. But you're absolutely right. Women did inherit.
And, you know, in fact, wasn't the white woman almost made to seem like a victim in many times, because the slave master, who's generally her husband, was constantly raping the slaves, and she couldn't do anything about it to stop him. So she was sort of a victim of all this. Did you find that in your studies?
So there certainly was also, you know, this idea that because of this, that white women who were, you know, also, you know, subjected to a paternalistic society might be natural allies, right, of the enslaved. But again, and that was one reason why there was this assumption that women wouldn't be actively involved. They would be maybe passively involved in the slave trade. But again, that turned out not to be true. Significant numbers of white women were actively involved in the trade. Mm.
How significant? You said one third earlier of women were in the marketplace. Is that the figure that is sort of, you know, used to establish their participation in the slave trade?
So this is new research and limited. You know, this is hard work to do, and so. The economist at Ohio State University started by looking at New Orleans, the largest slave market in the U.S. during two particular periods, 1856 to 1861. And that's where you get nearly a third of all the transactions involved women buying and selling. He also looked at an earlier period in New Orleans in 1830, where about 16% of the transactions involved white women actively involved in the market. So it's limited, you know, in terms of scope, but really important and instructive, because it starts to put numbers on the phenomenon mm-hmm. that we now know.
So, Professor Swarms, how did the white women's in management of enslaved people within households contribute to the larger economic framework of slavery?
Well, I mean, it's everyone in a household benefited from, you know, the enslavement of Black people, right? White women, and one of the other interesting findings was that white women tended to largely enslave Black women, or at very high rates. And part of the thinking about why that happened is because, white women in domestic households wanted folks who could work for them in the areas that they controlled, in the cleaning and the caring for children and the sewing and the laundry, et cetera. So you see white women owning, more likely to own Black women than Black men. There's also a thought too by the economists who started quantifying this, that, you know, again, this notion that white women at the time, you know, were divorced from, you know, the ugly business of the market, that, you know, there may, that again, you know, simply may not be true, and that white women may have ended up enslaving Black women more because that's a smart investment, right? Because if you happen to own a Black woman, you also own her children. And he believes that, you know, that kind of, you know, ugly, awful financial strategy may have been partially behind this as well.
Well, any children that a Black woman might have had would probably have been biracial, or would have been the result of rapes, or were the slaves allowed to actually marry and procreate?
Oh yeah. You know, and obviously rape is one of the endemic and horrifying traits of the American slave trade. But no, of course, people had husbands and wives. Black people, we all did, all throughout. And in fact, one of the horrors of the slave trade was that this buying and selling tore apart so many Black families.
So you said earlier that, and you pointed out, you know, rightly so, that there were women that resisted slavery, white women that resisted slavery, and they were part of the abolitionist movement. How would you characterize the scope of that? How many were involved in that abolitionist?
So there are notable figures, as I mentioned, but, you know, they were anomalies. I mean, you know, women going out to speak publicly in any way or fashion were frankly anomalies. So it's important to note them. It was not a widespread thing. And in fairness to the women of the time, you know, there were not many avenues either for women as a whole, white women too, to kind of engage in that activity. But abolitionism for men and women, white men and women, was a segment, small segment of the population.
So we're going to take a quick 60-second break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how all this is really relevant and impacts our society and our politics today. We are speaking with Professor Rachel Swarms, and we'll be back in a moment.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of Monday, December 2nd. On Thursday, the 5th of December, two events are coming up. First, the Howard County Racial Equity Strategic Plan Community Feedback Forum will be held from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at Howard Community College. Later that evening, Africa World Now Project and Bloom Bars will present a screening of the film We Rise for Our Land by Kurt Otabenga Orderson. The screening runs from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Bloom Bars, located on 11th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Saturday, the 7th of November, the Justice Involved Fatherhood Forum will take place from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. This forum will be held at the Creative Suitland Arts Center in Suitland, Maryland. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Whether it's a rally, workshop, forum, or community gathering, Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., 2 weeks in advance of your event. Space is limited, so submissions are considered in the order received. The Social Justice Calendar is one more way WPFW connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and joining me in the Zoom studio is Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University, Professor Rachel Swarms. She writes about race and history for the New York Times, and her article that we are discussing this morning is Scholars Thought or Believe That White Women Were Passive Enslavers, but they were not. So, Professor Swarms, why do you suppose white women were sort of given a pass when it came to their role in slavery?
It's one of the reasons, one of the questions I had too was like, how did this narrative emerge and take hold and for so long? And as I mentioned, Dr. Stephanie Jones-Rogers, who is the scholar at California Berkeley, who wrote the book recently about this, challenging this narrative, I asked her exactly that. And she said, you know, there are a number of reasons. One is that there were these laws that, you know, on the books that said women couldn't amass property and wealth, right? So if you just looked at that, you might think, okay, they couldn't do it. There was also, these notions of white womanhood, right? And, the ugly business of buying and selling human beings would be something left to men. This idea that women and enslaved people both subjected to, the domination of a white male paternalistic society might be allies. What folks didn't look at and what she did look at and which got her started was what enslaved people were reporting. And once you started looking at that and realizing that all these enslaved Black people are reporting these women who are actively buying and selling people, engaging in physical violence that they are wielding themselves in the homes, that there's more to look at. And once she started looking, she found it, in letters from male slave traders to white slave traders. She realized, oh, wait, there are these state laws that actually explicitly allowed white women to whip enslaved people, to acquire enslaved people, whether they were married or not. And she says it was the voices of the enslaved that really inspired her to go looking.
And so she actually was able to interview some of the relatives of the enslaved, or
so she looked at the these narratives that were taken in the 1930s of a formerly enslaved people who were enslaved as children mostly or teenagers at that time. They were elders by the time they were interviewed. And mm-hmm. and these records, these interviews capture, the active involvement of white women in the slave trade. Mm.
So the Emancipation Proclamation was signed on January 1st, 1863. It's almost January 1st, 2025, almost 162 years later. Why focus on the white women's role in slavery now, today? What relevance does it have to today that white women were major slave owners, and how does that impact our current realities and issues and politics? Professor?
So, you know, I think for the scholars who were digging into this work, they were digging into it before this last election, and because they feel like this history of enslavement and how fundamental it was to our country, it's really important for there to be a clear-eyed understanding that men and women were actively participants. So they weren't thinking about today. But I think anyone who reads that article thinks about today. And I think they do too, even though that was not the purpose of their research. I think it raised for a lot of people, you know, and for a lot of the people who read my story in the New York Times last week, it raised, you know, the questions of, you know, these tensions between white women and Black women, you know, that we've seen in moments, important moments in history, going back to, you know, the fight for the vote, right? We're talking about after emancipation, you know, the racism that was explicitly expressed by some of the suffragettes, right? The white women pushing for the vote, tensions during the civil white rights movement, you know, and looking at politics, if we look at the last two elections, just starting there, you know, white women have been supporters of Trump by a majority. And, you know, there's, you know, quite a long history of white women supporting Republican candidates, which there's that divergence there. And I think that's what, you know, that's what this research, I think, brings to mind to a lot of people who read it.
In fact, out of the last 17 presidential elections, white women have an allegiance to the Republican Party. The majority of white women, we should say, have an allegiance to the Republican Party, and they've only voted Democratic in two elections. And I'm not quite sure which two those were, but, you know, so that makes a very strong historical statement about their allegiance to the Republican Party. And it's often said, you know, many observers of this recent election and their overwhelming support for Trump, it was said that they were actually in support of the values of the Republican Party. And they voted basically on the issues of immigration and the economy and the state of democracy in this country. What are your thoughts about that, Professor?
So, you know, it's very interesting to look at what, you know, the numbers show, just as you were discussing. In this last election, 53% of white women voted for Trump, 46% voted for Harris. This is from the Washington Post's analysis of the exit polls. And that was actually pretty consistent with what you saw in 2016. It is interesting and important to note that there are some notable difference when you add education to the mix. So if you add education to the mix, you see a different story. So for instance, white women who are college graduates this time around, 58% of them voted for Harris, for the Democrats, 41% voted for Trump. And again, if you were to look at non-college educated white women, you would see just the opposite. 63% of non-college educated white women voted for Trump. Only 35% voted for Harris. So education is, and there were similar numbers in 2016. Education is, you know, having a role here with college educated women in the white women in the past two elections. Voting Democratic, but not enough to carry the, you know, white women as a whole, you know, in terms of numbers, still in terms of numbers, white women as a whole majority voted for Trump.
You know, one of the things this research sort of informs me is that many of us wondered, how can women vote for Trump when he is a man who has been heard on tape trying to steal an election? He's also been he admittedly assaults women sexually and brags about it and was caught on tape doing so. You know, he was convicted basically of raping a woman. And so you wonder, but then, you know, this kind of, when you think about, think historically, they've been excusing white males' sexual activity for decades. And it started back in during slavery. You know, they, I don't know, they looked the other way. They saw the brown children on the plantation and it didn't matter enough, I would imagine, to break up any marriages. So, you know, this is sort of a historical pattern that we see here. And it sort of paints an entirely different profile of some white women. And as you said, the uneducated white woman is the one that tends to fit that profile more than others. So is this knowledge really just more or less an academic exercise, Professor? Why is it important to correct the historical record? There are serious efforts underway now to homogenize the teaching of slavery.
You know, I think the points you were making were really interesting. I mean, I think there was certainly thinking that, particularly given the stakes for abortion, that white women might shift their historic voting patterns this time around. That did not happen. And one of the interesting, political analysis that I've read is that, you know, because of these referendums in states where you could vote to enshrine abortion rights within your state, then you could also protect yourself, protect abortion rights in your state, and still, vote Trump at the top of the ticket. And it turns out that a lot of women did that. I think, you know, when you talk about the importance of this and the challenges that those of us who do this kind of research on slavery and its legacies are facing, it's important because, you know, slavery, you know, fueled the growth of so many of our institutions. It's so intrinsically tied into our economy. It affects who we are and how we got here. You know, the wealth gap. I mean, there's so much, but there is this effort, and we can see it playing out all around the country, to limit the teaching about this, to ban books in some places about this. History has become a battleground, really, in terms of, efforts to try to suppress, the teaching and reading about this history. And it really speaks to who we are. So I think this research that I was describing is really important because this was not something that, you know, men just engaged in. This is something that was societal, women and men.
Mm-hmm. And so it's important to correct the record, to get the record straight.
Absolutely.
Historically. Absolutely. And, you know, this effort to take so-called DEI, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, these efforts to remove that are basically based on the fact that they're concerned that little white girls and little white boys might be offended or hurt or upset by these facts being taught in a classroom. No concern whatsoever for how it might be impact, how slavery might be impacting the children of African descent.
And frankly, I've always thought that and I teach students at NYU. I think this is our history. It's not Black history. It's American history. It's our history. And Honestly, it's history that we all need to know. It's history that we all need to understand. It's history that we all need to grapple with. And again, we can't understand where we are now if we're not willing to look in the rearview mirror. We have to do that. We have to.
What kind of reaction do you get from your students at NYU
You know,
who?
and this is where I think, honestly, you do read about politicians' parents who are saying, this is going to make our kids feel bad, and they shouldn't be subjected to this. I find, a great interest in understanding this history, and a great interest in grappling with this history among my white students. And so, and again, it's hard history. I mean, I spent the past 15 years, focused on this. It's hard for me as a Black woman, right? This is not easy. It's not easy for anyone. But slavery was foundational to the evolution of the United States, and we need to know that. We need to understand it.
What percentage of your students are white?
Well, I'm at NYU, and so the majority are white.
Have you been pressured in any way to alter your agenda, your course in person?
No. I teach a course for graduate students and undergraduate students called Investigating Injustice or Reporting on Racial Justice, where we look at the history of racial violence in the United States. They look at lynchings in the North. Again, let's challenge some of our traditional narratives. There were lynchings in the North. We look at the history of racial violence, and then we look at hate crimes, contemporary hate crimes, trying to look at kind of have an understanding of racial violence in the past, and then look at what's happening today. And that kind of work is encouraged where I am, but I know colleagues, professors in Florida who are, have had to describe to me having to go through their syllabi and take things out because they are afraid, that they could get in trouble for doing this kind of work.
So are you concerned about Project 2025, the impact that it might have on your work as a professor?
So, you can't do this work and look around at the book bans and all the efforts across the country to limit and restrict the teaching and not be worried. In terms of the work I do, in terms of looking at how institutions are and municipalities are dealing with the legacies of slavery, I also feel a bit encouraged. When I look around and see these efforts, these fledgling efforts at dealing with the reparations question, for instance, institution, universities, and municipalities. The state of California is looking at this. New York. I don't think that I ever thought that I would see, an institution like Georgetown University saying, hey, we've got to put together a reconciliation fund and contribute, raise money to benefit the descendants of, enslaved people who, helped to save this university. I never thought I would see these kinds of efforts. But I feel like it's not a surprise. You have kind of this two trains running, these kind of fledgling efforts at kind of grappling with this history, and at the same time, folks trying to, on the other side, limit the teaching in some states.
And finally, Professor Swarms, was there anything you had to leave out of your New York Times article that you care to share with us this
No,
morning?
no, no. I. It's one of the great privileges of my work that, you know, I have the freedom to report independently as a longtime writer for the New York Times. It's something that I really value, and I think that this kind of thing is important for all of us.
Associate Professor of Journalism at NYU University, Professor Rachel Swarms. Thank you so much for being our guest this morning. As she writes about history for the New York Times, her articles about Georgetown University's roots in slavery touched off a national conversation about American universities and their ties to this painful period in our history. Thank you so much, Professor, for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for today's What's at Stake. Thank you for listening. Next week, Professor Fahima Seck will be your host. We had production assistance today from listener Mike Francis. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Masella. And up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Ife Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and as the late, great Nelson Mandela said, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.
Greetings, this is Brother Jamil, host of Yardbird Suites. During this season of lights, we ask that you remember WPFW and the sustenance we provide to the community. You can give the gift of WPFW from December 15th through December 31st during our year-end membership campaign. It is indeed your generosity that has allowed WPFW to provide news, music, and information to the people since 1977. Donations can be made anytime at wpfw.org or by calling 800-222-9739. We wish you truth and peace now and in the new year.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
Happy holiday. I'm Robin Holden.
I'm Miyuki Williams. WPFW is wishing you a happy holiday and are inviting our listeners to an open house extravaganza as we say goodbye to our 1990 K Street location.
We're offering our listeners and supporters this holiday gathering as a way of thanking you for your support. On Sunday, December 15th, from 4:30 p.m. until 7:30 p.m.
Stellar programmers James Funk,
Captain Fly,
DJ Lance Reynolds,
and DJ Abby will provide the music.
Food and drink will be made available.
Details, including how to RSVP, available at WPFWFM.org.
Happy holidays!
The WPFW Local Station Board presents their final Town Hall meeting of 2024 on Saturday, December 7th at New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., from noon until 2:30 p.m. The Town Hall will also be on Zoom, and the link can be found at wpfwfm.org. As this will be our last Town Hall at our present location, 1990 K Street Northwest, we hope that you will attend this important meeting to discuss WPFW's relocation plans, as well as other issues facing the station. If attending in person, healthy refreshments will be served, and plenty of street parking is available. We hope to see you there, noon, December 7th, at New Bethany Baptist Church.
December 5th will mark the 100th birthday of Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe. WPFW is the proud media sponsor for the Friday, December 6th film and discussion, lifting up the legacy and contributions of this South African Pan-Africanist revolutionary and founder of the PAC, Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania.
When you look at Sobukwe, You really look, first of all, at the giant.
He had almost an aura about him.
There was power in him.
A very bright, brilliant man.
The defier of the undefiable.
The film, Sobukwe, A Great Soul, celebrates the life of Mangaliso Sobukwe, restoring him to his rightful place as a leading figure in South African history, a place even the current South African government has failed to recognize. Moderated by WPFW's own Katia Stitt, the discussion after the film will feature Sepo Sobukwe, grandson of Robert Sobukwe, the filmmaker via Zoom, Mickey Madoda Dube, and Nancy Wright of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. That's Remembering Robert Sobukwe.